and 2000 UTC.
Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Thursday, September 14, 2023. The head of the UN mission to Sudan quits his job.
It's a very good way out for him because he is already declared persona non grata, so the UN cannot force him on the government of Sudan.
And media groups and journalists in South Sudan say the working environment in the country is very hostile.
We would like to see the government of South Sudan show even more commitment to provide an enabling environment for media to thrive.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some politicians in Sudan are expressing mixed views over the decision by Volker Perthes to quit his job as the head of the UN mission to Sudan. A prominent member of the Islamist Popular Congress Party says that this resignation is a loss to the pro-democracy groups in Sudan. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Juba.
The United Nations top envoy to Sudan, Volker Perthes, announced Wednesday that he has stepped down. The Sudanese government declared Perthes as a persona non grata in April, accusing him of some biases. He presented a report on the situation in Sudan to the UN Security Council Wednesday and asked the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres to relieve him from the Sudan mission. Kamal Omar, a prominent member of the Popular Congress Party, says Perthes' resignation is a loss to groups working to achieve democracy in Sudan. He says Perthes played a significant role in unifying different Sudanese political parties.
We as political forces have benefited so much from unlimited support from the UN mission. The mission has contributed a lot in Sudan's political history, and we are here giving testimony to his efficiency and his keenness on the political processes in Sudan.
Omar says Perthes' resignation could affect Sudan's relations with the international community. But Ali Youssef, who is a Sudanese diplomat, says Perthes' resignation is long overdue. Youssef says Perthes had no other choice except to quit after continual pressure from the Sudanese government.
It's a very good way out for him because he is already declared persona non grata, so the UN cannot force him on the government of Sudan. His resignation is, I think, is the right thing to do.
Abdul Mukhtar Musa, a political science lecturer at the Khartoum University, downplayed the impact of Perthes' resignation. Mukhtar says for nearly 3 years, the UN envoy did very little to identify the key political issue in Sudan. He says he believes Sudan will still maintain good relations with the UN and other international bodies.
I don't think the resignation of the UN special envoy to Sudan has any or will have any impact on the political process in Sudan. I think the solution for the Sudanese crisis lies in South Sudan. I mean, it is related to the domestic politics.
Volker Perthes, a German national, was appointed the UN Secretary General's special representative for Sudan to lead the United Nations Integrated Transitional Assistance Mission in Sudan, or UNITAMS, in January 2021. On Wednesday, Human Rights Watch and 50 other rights organizations called upon the UN Security Council to take action and stop the conflict in Sudan. The rights groups say after more than 5 months of fighting, abuses are on the rise and civilians are facing widespread attacks. Akshaya Kumar, the director of crisis advocacy at the Human Rights Watch, says her office has documented violations of the laws of war by both parties in Sudan.
We've looked at instances of targeted killings on the base of ethnicity, the use of sexual violence by fighters against women, including targeting people for their activism or journalism. We've looked at instances of aerial bombardment or the use of explosive weapons, which have wide effect in really densely populated areas.
The Human Rights Watch says over 20 million people, 42% of the Sudan's population, face acute food insecurity, and 6 million are just a step away from famine. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
As you just heard, the United Nations Special Envoy and head of the UN mission in Sudan, known as UNITAMS, announced his resignation Wednesday. Volker Perthes issued a warning that the conflict in Sudan has the potential to escalate to a full-blown civil war. Nabil Biayo spoke with Khalid Khair, a Sudanese analyst and the director of the Khartoum-based think tank, the Confluence Advisory. She says she was not surprised by Perthes' resignation.
Not a moment too soon, and it has been a long time coming, because frankly, having lost the confidence of one of the belligerent parties, it made it very difficult for him to be able to do his job. The mandate for the mission had changed so much since first the coup and now the war, that I think he had struggled to find a place for himself within the very quickly shifting political landscape in the country. I think it's time for a fresh start, a new envoy from the UN who can bring confidence, who can bring a clean slate, and hopefully engage with the belligerent parties.
Yes, and Perthes was declared persona non grata by the army, and he was accused of bias and interfering in Sudanese affairs in ways that violated the country's sovereignty. And he's been operating from outside the country since June. And many in Sudan consider him part of the problem, actually. The problem with the transition to democracy, the lead up to the current conflict, and even his role during the conflict. How do you assess his role?
Well, I mean, from the outset, I think it's important to remember that the blame for this conflict and how it was sparked lies primarily with the warring parties, with Generals Burhan and Hemeti and their partners. That said, Volker Perthes, I think, was remiss in not recognizing the signs of an impending conflict, and he's not the only diplomat to do so. But I think in his particular role within a political mission by the UN, he should have been far more adept at reading the trajectory of events. What we had seen him present to the United Nations during Security Council meetings on Sudan, etc., were very rosy pictures of how the political process that preceded the war was moving along. And he was reassuring the Security Council that there would be a final agreement very soon on the horizon, partially because he was listening to the wrong interlocutors, partially because he was privileging the narrative of a very narrow range of interlocutors. Had he been able and had he prioritized much deeper, much more significant, much more meaningful engagement with a variety of political Sudanese stakeholders, he would have been able to see the clear signs that so many of us saw, that a war was on the sort of very near horizon.
I've actually heard this criticism before, that he misled the world in the lead up to the war until the last minute, either intentionally or unintentionally. But then he was appointed as head of the UN mission to Sudan, UNITAMS, in January 2021 to support Sudan's transition to democratic and civilian rule, like you just mentioned. He resigns now with a warning of a full-blown civil war engulfing Sudan. What will be his legacy? How will he be remembered in Sudan?
I think, you know, yesterday's briefing was probably one of the better briefings that he had done, because I suppose he no longer feared the consequences of telling the truth and sort of the unvarnished truth. It comes too little too late, frankly. There are so many who have been raising the alarm within civil society that a full-blown civil war was on the horizon. I think Volker Perthes' legacy will be that he not only sort of misled the world at the UN level because of his inability to raise the alarm on the war before it happened, but effectively that this war and the way the international community responded to it happened on his watch, partially because the UN, and this is sort of beyond beyond him, the UN relied so heavily on him as a weak SRSG to shepherd its engagement on Sudan after the coup and then now post after the beginning of the war. What we'd like to see now is a new envoy with a clearer mandate on the protection of civilians, already part of the UN UNITAM's mandate, but more focused on that, with a higher level envoy who can command not just the attention of belligerent parties and political actors in Sudan, but also across the region, Horn of Africa, Sahel, as well as further afield in the Gulf. That will be critical to the United Nations' ability to engage more meaningfully on Sudan. But it has to be said, the political will of the United Nations to be more meaningfully engaged on Sudan has been missing for a while, and we've seen almost entire absence of the UN since this war started. Partially, that's because SRSG Perthes was effectively a stumbling block to the United Nations' ability to engage. And so hopefully with his exit, we will see more of that. But I think serious questions need to be asked within the United Nations chamber about how much they are prioritizing, or how little they are prioritizing Sudan, and what calamitous consequences that will have, not just for Sudan, but for the region. Next week is General Assembly. It's the perfect time to ask these questions at a global stage and at a time when world leaders will all be congregated in one area.
That's Khaled Khair, director of the Khartoum-based think tank, the Conference Advisory. She spoke with my colleague Nabil Biagio from Washington this past hour. Some media groups and journalists in South Sudan say the working environment in the country is characterized by threats, intimidation, and arbitrary arrests. The chairperson of the Association for Media Development in South Sudan, or AMDIS, says despite the enactment of media laws, censorship remains widespread across the country. For VOA News, Dengai Deng reports from Bor.
Kong Pal Chang, the chairperson of AMDIS, says media groups and journalists in South Sudan have a long way to go to achieve a conducive environment.
For us to achieve that is not going to be easy, but it has been a journey, because when we started, it has been hard. It has been difficult for journalists, even for the media houses, to operate, because from the beginning, there were no media law. When media law came in, still there were some problems. Those days, many journalists left the country, ran away, some were killed. There used to be a lot of intimidation and harassment. I'm not saying these things are not there, especially intimidation, harassment, and arrest. They are still persisting.
Chang says despite the establishment of the media authority to regulate media operations, censorship by the government of South Sudan remains widespread.
They are trying to silence the media so that the public does not know what they are doing or what is their failure to deliver. You cannot tell today when there is no journalist who is arrested, things are okay. No. But when a story breaks out, like the history of the slapping by the mayor, that story went viral, so many journalists are being threatened. We have been called to bring it down to our pitch. You see that? It's because the leader don't want to be held accountable with things that they are doing, which are unlawful.
Jacob Maiju Korok is South Sudan's Deputy Minister of Information, Communication, Technology and Postal Services. Korok insists the media environment is conducive despite isolated incidents of arrest and intimidations.
The media environment is conducive nowadays. You never had somebody that harassed because of what he writes or what he says. So the media environment is okay. They have a very good conducive environment. And the government will allow them to do whatever they want to do. So what that incident, that a single incident that happened in the parliament, it's not actually generalized for everybody, or generalized for all situations.
Speaking during the ongoing annual Sustainability Forum and Media Network in Juba, Darren Manning, the USAID Acting Deputy Mission Director, calls on South Sudan government to do more to help the media grow by supporting the implementation of relevant laws.
We would like to see the government of South Sudan show even more commitment to provide an enabling environment for media to thrive. This can be achieved by demonstrating support for the implementation of relevant laws, as well as commitment to upholding international principles that promote freedom of expression and the freedom of the press.
Darren says the government should open up civic space to pave the way for consolidating trust and cohesion in the country. Last month, some journalists were briefly detained and their gear confiscated by security operatives when they interviewed SPLM in opposition lawmakers who boycotted sitting the third reading of the draft budget for 2023-2024. South Sudan ranks 128th and Sudan ranks 151st out of 180 countries in the annual World Press Freedom Index, released last year by Reporters Without Borders. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaideng in Bor.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Moroccans come together to help earthquake victims. Stay tuned for latest update on that story.
If you are in Sudan witnessing events taking place there, or if you have family you are talking to there, you can call us on WhatsApp and let us know how things are going there. Dial the international code plus one, then 202-258-3076. The number again, the international code plus one, then 202-258-3076.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The damage caused by the most powerful earthquake to hit Morocco in over a century has been enormous, but residents say it has also shown the resilience and the spirit of the people. Emmanuel Hodi Baye visited Moulay Brahim, one of the affected villages, and has this story narrated by Aouzouma Compaoré.
The town of Moulay Brahim is near the epicenter of the earthquake that struck Morocco on September the 8th. This explains not only the extent of the damage recorded here, but also the large influx of people from other villages and towns who have come to help with rescue efforts.
I saw how many people have nothing left, nothing to eat, nothing to sleep on, nothing to live on. No one can remain indifferent. I really like all the people like me who live in Marrakech, because I know there are a lot of them. I'd like us to look after a few people, not just now. I'd like us to look after them now and keep in touch with them, and over time make contact. I'd love if people could come here and help out, and we all help each other out.
After helping to bury 22 of his relatives, Moulay Brahim resident Abdelhamid Aouzal joined efforts to collect for those in need.
We are trying to put together everything we have received from citizens and residents of other villages. We are trying to gather everything here in the headquarters of this association, and we have organized the commissions to share with them afterwards. There are families in several surrounding areas here, so we are still at work.
Bader Manaouch, a primary school teacher who taught students in the High Atlas Mountains in Morocco, based in a village near the city of Assila, echoes the sentiments of those on the ground about how civilians come together in this time of crisis.
Many videos of people, they don't have nothing, but they give in. And this is known about Moroccan people. Moroccan people are ready, and you find them there whenever it's about like cooperation, solidarity, cohesion. every time someone or some parts in Morocco need something, they are all together. It's like a body.
The earthquake heavily hit the High Atlas Mountains, killing nearly 3,000 people and injuring over 5,000, according to official accounts. The earthquake is the country's deadliest since 1960. For Emmanuel Modi Dubai in Moulay Ibrahim, Morocco, Orzuma Compaoré, VOA News.
The COVID-19 pandemic has changed the way Americans work, with millions of people working from home at least part of the time. Experts say offices must evolve to meet the needs. The U.S. General Services Administration, the agency that oversees federal buildings, is trying to determine what that means. VOA's Dora McQuar visited its workplace innovation lab to learn more.
Parts of the Workplace Innovation Lab feel like a traditional office. Other sections look more like home. All of this furniture was brought in by private companies. They're partnering with the U.S. General Services Administration, or GSA, the agency in charge of federal buildings, to see if any of these setups represent the office of the future. Here's Chuck Hardy, the GSA's chief architect.
The office should be a magnet, not a mandate. We're looking to have an office that brings people back to it purposefully.
During this year-long experiment, any federal worker is allowed to reserve space at the lab. In return, they provide feedback about their experience.
It's not a one-size-fits-all. And in certain agencies and certain offices, it can be multiple solutions. And so we're looking at what is that mix of a solution.
What experts already know is that the same old office no longer works in a post-COVID world. People who spent the pandemic working from the comfort of home aren't excited about coming back to cubicle farms and mostly empty offices. Aditya Sanghvi is head of real estate for a management consulting firm.
The offices that we have largely been designed as a place that people need to come. Many of them are cube farms that are really boring, unexciting, and nobody wants to be there. The office has suddenly become a choice. It's an option. And the office has to be better for someone than working from home and enduring the commute to come into the office.
At the Innovation Lab, that means having better acoustics and technology and providing a more agile office.
But this is actually a table that's made up a lot of little wood pieces that actually folds away.
Where furniture can be moved around to better suit workers' needs. Sanghvi envisions immersive conference rooms where there's no difference between in-person and remote meetings, and maybe even office help for worker errands.
So one of the reasons that a lot of people work from home is that they have to pick up the kids, they have to do dry cleaning, they have to take care of the dog. And so what if there were pet care in the building? What if there was child care in the building? Things that actually make it that my life is easier because I'm going to the office, not that it's harder because I'm going to the office.
Office planners of the future will likely try to address three main criteria. Again, Chief Architect Hardy.
Has to be quality, has to be serving a purpose, but it still has to be beautiful. And so that's what we're looking for here is you don't want to go into a building that looks like you're in a basement on you're on the 10th floor of a building kind of thing.
Which means the office of the future could look and feel a little bit more like home. Dora McQuar, VOA News, Washington.
From Washington, we move to East Africa, where experts say research is key when it comes to offering healthcare services in East Africa. Regional healthcare experts are in Nairobi for 3 days discussing fundamental issues that affect health sector. Maureen Ojiambo tells us about the work of Medic East Africa, the largest healthcare platform and medical laboratory market in the region.
Medic East Africa is working to shape the healthcare industry in a sustainable way. The three-day event includes more than 5,000 delegates, among them government officials, healthcare professionals, and investors from across the globe to debate the latest healthcare and lab innovations that could redefine healthcare delivery in East Africa. Speaking in Nairobi during the opening of the event, the exhibition director for Informal Markets, Tom Coleman, said that the event is providing an ideal platform for the East Africa African healthcare industry to build relationships with stakeholders from around the world.
Kenya is the healthcare hub for the East Africa region, and what we see over the next few years is potential growth working with our partners, Ministry of Health, Kenyan Health Federation, and also AMREF. There is a huge bounce back. You've seen a lot of international presence here, a lot of investment, but also a lot of local manufacturing companies now really presenting, you know, some high technology. One of the major issues that we have here as well is public health and also the supply chain. I think working with our partners, especially the Ministry of Health.
The conference will also address crucial issues and identify solutions for challenges facing the health sector. Experts say public-private partnerships are key to the challenges that are facing healthcare in Africa. Coleman says health stakeholders will be able to determine the best course of action to deliver quality healthcare across East Africa.
This is very different to any other event that happens in the region. There's no other event that brings some of the biggest bellwether clients in the world, like Siemens, Mindray, United Imaging. But also we have international pavilions. So we have an international pavilion from Germany, from China, from Korea, from India, from Pakistan. Something that other events, you know, aren't really showcasing at the moment. Huge opportunity with some of the companies that have never been to Kenya and never been to the East Africa region.
The United Nations say Africa has got a higher disease burden globally, with the continent facing a shortage of healthcare workers. The Kenya Medical Association, KMA, says both private and public hospitals need to do a thorough disease research. Simon Kigondu is the president of the Kenya Medical Association.
We, as a country, do need to do research on a lot of the illnesses that we have, and we have seen that local research actually does bring local data, which has on several occasions actually changed like management of some diseases.
Regional and international experts are expected to share insights and best practices on healthcare excellency, public health and equity to address the challenges facing public and private healthcare. Reporting for Views, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Sacramento, California.
Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202-630-8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202-630-8011.
And I'm waiting to hear your comments tomorrow, where we'll normally sample some voice and text messages from our listeners. That's all we prepared for you this Thursday, September 14, 2023. We now leave you with Magic System and the song Gau. have been listening to Magic System and the song Gawu. Don't forget to visit voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you miss this program, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Joy Gills, we wish you a good evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.